Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. This is the concluding episode of a two-part discussion with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe on Russia's history and its reemergence as a rival to the U.S. for global power today. In part one, we covered important political and military events from the origins of Russia in the Middle Ages through the Russian Revolution and the emergence of Joseph Stalin. In this episode, we continue the discussion from the period of Stalin's rule up to Russia today under Vladimir Putin, and we conclude with an analysis of the implications of Russia's revival for U.S. foreign and military policy. So in 1924, Joseph Stalin takes over from Vladimir Lenin, who was very sick with strokes for some time. What kind of a regime does he set up in terms of the national security apparatus and in terms of his relationship with the military?
Well, what I think is interesting is you can see a lot of parallels nowadays to Stalin's system. Stalin was very national security focused. He expanded the NKVD, which later became the KGB. He gave them more powers to punish on their own, to arrest on their own, to execute on their own. He put in despots who thrived off of executing people for no reason. He was frightened of the Red Army Officer Corps, and he actually liquidated most of the Officer Corps. In fact, he liquidated, they say out of like 90 members of the general staff, he liquidated like 83 ballpark. I don't know the exact figures, but it was about that. Almost 90%, if not more, of the general staff was just executed. So he feared the military. Now, one thing that I'd like listeners to think about, in Nazi Germany, they had 2,000 Gestapo officers for the entire Reich, and all the power was in the military. In Russia, all of the power was in the NKVD, and the military was marginalized, its leaders were executed or thrown in prison, and it was given very little funding. If you look at the United States today, the biggest organs of the U.S. government is not the military, it's the national security apparatus, it's Homeland Security, it's all of these different agencies, the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, you know.
That seems to be where the focus in the United States is going since 9/11, since 2001. And while our standing army is relatively small, it's like 1 million. And while we do have...
And they're shrinking it.
And yes, it's getting smaller. It's not where the money is today. And the Washington Post did an excellent story, I think a year or two ago, about this burgeoning spy agencies in Washington, all the hundreds, I think thousands of consulting firms that are living off of it. And hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent since 9/11 on this new intelligence, national security establishment.
And it's not because the government's afraid of terrorists. It's because the government's afraid of the people. The same thing that motivated Stalin. When your national security apparatus is better funded, better equipped, better armed, and better manned than your army is, who does the government really fear? The people or foreign enemies?
But he was very effective at what he did because he stayed in power from 1924 to 1953. He survived World War II. What were Russia's objectives in terms of foreign policy in the late 1930s? What did they want vis-a-vis Germany? What was their relationship with the United States?
They were frightened of Germany. They wanted to ally themselves originally with the United States, France, and Britain. But, well, Stalin did. In spite of all his anti-capitalist rhetoric, he wanted to be allied with the capitalist powers against the Nazis, because what he wanted to see was the Nazis and the capitalist powers destroy each other, and then he'd step in and pick up the pieces. Problem was, is the Western powers would have none of it. They didn't want to deal with Stalin. They didn't want to be allies with a communist. And particularly Churchill knew the despot that Stalin was. And so he allied himself with Hitler. And a lot of this was because Stalin was, and he was more concerned with controlling people domestically and sparking communist revolution than he was out and out invading his neighbors. He didn't have a taste for that because he was a coward. Much in the same way that, again, you know, you see strong parallels in history. President Obama doesn't want to invade Syria. He wants to topple it with quote-unquote democratic revolutionaries. It's no different than Stalin trying to top governments in Czechoslovakia with Bolshevik red revolutionaries during the 30s.
Well, you mentioned that he was very upset that that Lenin had conceded Russian-controlled territories in the West. Did he have ambitions to recover Soviet style, recover a Russian empire, communist style?
Well, more than that, he dreamed one day of a global empire, but his global empire would be built largely off of sparking Bolshevik revolutions worldwide. He believed that the home of the Communist International was going to be Moscow. So he was going to dominate the world not by having Red Army troops march into Prague, but rather by sparking Bolshevik revolutions in Czechoslovakia, in Greece, in Italy, in Germany, in Britain. That's why behind every Red movement worldwide, you saw the hand of the NKVD funneling money to these movements. Even the Communist Party in the U.S. in the 1930s, you saw the hand of the NKVD funneling money there. Because
do you think that Lenin would have had such an expansionary policy to promote worldwide revolution? Is that part of being a communist, do you think? Or does it have to do with Russian nationalism or what?
No, it has to do with being a communist especially. I mean, Russia has an imperial streak, but communism inherently, the idea of the international says that, you know, one day we will have people's revolutions worldwide, everybody will follow communism, and we will have a world united under a red so-called workers' utopia, which is why you have the Communist International, whereas if you want to contrast that with, for example, the fascist movement in Italy, for example, which fought the communists, viewed itself largely, or Franco's fascist movement in Spain, was nationalist. They didn't necessarily, Franco didn't want to have a Falange government in London. All he cared about was Spain for the Spanish,
right.
You know, Spanish independence, you know, Spanish nationalism.
Well, now, Stalin formed an alliance, at least temporarily, with the Germans in order to get half of Poland, right?
Well, it was in order to protect himself because he was frightened of the Germans. He formed an alliance with the Germans because he wanted the Germans to fight the West. The Germans, the Americans, the Brits, the French, we'd all fight each other. We would destroy each other. Then Stalin would step in and pick up the pieces by sponsoring Bolshevik revolutions worldwide. That was Stalin's line of logic.
I see.
But it backfired when Hitler invaded Russia.
What was the state of Russia's military when Hitler invaded Russia?
Oh, abysmal. Abysmal. I mean, all of the senior officer corps had been liquidated. So now all of your officers, or the vast majority of them, have no military or very limited military experience, or very limited command experience. The Russians suffered 3 million casualties in their army in peacetime under Stalin. Now just 3 to 4 million Russian soldiers were killed in peacetime.
What were they dying from?
They were being executed. It's the largest single loss of men in military history in peacetime. But it was because Stalin was executing him, so his army was demoralized. It was underfunded. It was under-equipped. These guys were under-trained. When war broke out, the Russian army folded like a deck of cards. They just collapsed. And the Germans were just rolling them back. Stalin disappeared to his office for 2 or 3 days. Nobody saw him, you know, because he couldn't believe what was happening.
And what was the state of their technology, their military equipment?
Their military equipment was decent, but the biggest problem was just it was so underfunded. All of his funding, all of his training, and all of his best and brightest went into the NKVD.
And of course, that national security apparatus isn't much use when you're being invaded by the Germans.
Of course not. And an analogous line of thought would be, if we were to enter a major war with Russia and China in the 21st century, Department of Homeland Security would not help and would not replace the man on the ground, and no amount of drones would replace the man on the ground or the fact that we've underfunded and under-equipped and under-trained our armed forces. That's exactly what happened in Russia. They did have great military technology. It just was underfunded, under-equipped,
so
and under-trained.
So how did they end up winning the war? Was it the German mistakes? Was it the Russian winter?
Really, it was German military mistakes. The Russian winter played a role, but it was really German military mistakes. The Russians, and the fact that we funneled a lot of aid to the Russians. A lot. And that's the reason why we opened the second front in the West. We were not involved in the war in Europe until 40. It had to be 44. So really, from 1940 up until 1944, Russia was going it alone.
Right, until the Normandy invasion in June of 44.
Exactly. And the whole reason for that was because Russia was really starting to buckle. And they said, look, you know, we need you to take some pressure off.
Yes.
And that's why you had the Normandy invasion ultimately.
But they had defeated the Germans at Stalingrad, right?
By that point, yes. But the fear the Russians had was that if the Germans took their troops from the Western Front and started to throw them into the Eastern Front, the Germans might be able to, at the very least, stop the Russians.
Well, now with the tide turning, the Normandy invasion, and the Russians' army is able to move west, and how does the war then end up benefiting them, the Allied victory?
The Russians begin to get an appetite for empire. Stalin realized something at the end of the war. Now, he defeated the Germans ultimately because Russia had an inexhaustible supply of men and material. And the disaster at Stalingrad, which was just due to Hitler's meddling in his generals' decision-making. Russia realized that they could take on anyone. Stalin particularly realized they could take on anyone. And moreover, he realized the Western powers were broke. He realized the Brits, the French, and the Americans were bankrupt after World War II. Now, America ended up actually prospering, but we wouldn't have if we had entered war with Russia. So Russia realized for the first time it was in an incredibly strong negotiating position. So they told the Americans, they said, look, okay, we want Eastern Europe and Poland. And FDR, who was very soft on communism to begin with, said, sure, go ahead. Yeah, take Eastern Europe. Take Poland. What do we care? You can have it. And, knock yourselves out there. Uncle Joe, who was FDR that coined that phrase. But Winston Churchill, on the other hand, said, we can't give up Eastern Europe to the Russians. Otherwise, we're letting an iron curtain fall upon Europe.
And Britain had gone to war over Poland. And now FDR was just giving it away as far as he was concerned.
Exactly. And there was at Yalta that FDR and Churchill really had it out, because Churchill said, we went to war. British prestige is at stake. We promised Poland its independence, and now you're just going to give it to the Bolsheviks? And FDR basically said, I don't care what you think. So now what you had is Russia in a position where it's dominate. It has political domination over the West, because they realize the Americans don't have the stomach for a fight. The only people who want to fight are the Brits, and they don't have the money to.
And does Stalin, in fact, realize his ambition to recreate the Russian Empire that was lost, in the Treaty of World War One? Is that the outcome? We have a new Russian Empire?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have probably the restoration of what the Russian Empire used to be. So it's again, Russia's militarily in its strongest position. Politically, it's in its strongest position. Again, economically, it was reeling from the war. But what stopped the Russian advance was the atom bomb being dropped on Japan. That's the whole reason why Truman dropped the bomb.
Yeah, modern revisionist historians really believe that it was a demonstration of power to the Russians.
Because the Russians at this time had turned east. They had, because part of their treaty with the U.S. was they had to go to war with Japan. So they were just acting upon
as soon as Germany surrendered, which it did in May of 1945, and the Russians jumped into the war against Japan, figuring they'd pick up some of the pieces in Asia.
Well, more than that, they were going to take they took Manchuria. Their plan was to actually seize the northern half of Japan and create a communist puppet regime in Japan.
I see.
Now, the difference
being
is—
being at war with Japan for all of maybe 3 months.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the difference is Russia could afford to throw a million men into the mix in Japan. They could afford a million casualties. Russians is no big deal. They knew the Americans would hesitate invading Japan. The Russians figured, we'll capitalize on this and we'll invade Japan ourselves. So the Americans said, we have to drop the nuke on Japan, get them to surrender before the Russians invade, and we have to demonstrate to the Russians that we have this wonder weapon, as the Germans would say, Wunderwaffen, so that they'll stop their advance. Well, and then just a few years later, the Russians got the bomb.
Well, now, the Patton, General Patton, the great American general, he wanted us to continue the war against the Russians as soon as the Germans surrendered. What would have happened if the government had followed Patton's recommendation? Were we strong enough to roll over the Russian army that had just defeated the German army on the Eastern Front?
I don't know if we would have rolled over the Russian army, but certainly I think if we had invaded Russia— well, first of all, we wouldn't politically find ourselves in the position we're in today with a new Russian empire and a new Russian czar. I think if we had really invaded Russia, well, first of all, the Russians initially, the large portions of the Russian populace supported the Nazis because they hated Stalin so much. Now imagine if you had the Western democracies entering Russia saying, look, unlike the Nazis, we're not going to subjugate you for being Slavs, and unlike Stalin, we're not going to execute you. I think we would have had the political momentum, especially amongst the Russian people, to kick Stalin out and install a Western-style democracy, a Western-style democratic government, which the Russians are capable of democracy. They are. It's not like the Chinese, who really are a society that for thousands of years have always had an emperor. So just because they call themselves communists, he's still the emperor.
It's more of an authoritarian streak in China, you'd say. Would the Russians have been happy with our controlling Eastern Europe? Are the Russians inherently very nervous when if they don't control the border areas?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If they don't control their borders, they are very nervous. And a lot of that has to do with their history of having been invaded. They like having buffer zones.
So they're not at all happy about the fact that in the wake, in the recent years, we're roping the former Warsaw Pact nations into various military alliances with the United States.
Not at all. And that's why you see them meddling in places like Georgia. I mean, right now in Georgia, you have a pro-Moscow president. They got rid of Saakashvili. They put in a pro-Moscow president. And now monuments to Stalin being originally from Georgia, monuments to Stalin are starting to erupt all over Georgia.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States. Going a long way then from Stalin to the current situation, he dies in 1953. It's amazing he held on to power for 30 years. His police state is somewhat dismantled by his successor, Nikita Khrushchev.
Well, there's a man in between, Malenkov,
yes,
who comes in between Khrushchev and Stalin, but he was only there for a short period of time, and then Nikita
basically
ousted him.
Khrushchev's in until 64, I believe, and there's this kind of a de-Stalinization under Khrushchev, right?
He has the head of Stalin's secret police, Beria, executed. So, I mean, there was like Khrushchev played the fool when Stalin was in power so that this way he could survive. And then the moment Stalin was out of power, he got some of his cohorts together and ousted all of Stalin's old guard.
Well, we know Khrushchev and Eisenhower and then Khrushchev and Kennedy were hoping to lessen the Cold War, but it did not happen, perhaps because of interference by the CIA. And there's some belief that the U-2 was sent up by the CIA or was given away by the CIA.
The one that crashed in Russia.
Just before Eisenhower was going to have a conference with Khrushchev. And again, Kennedy was a champion towards the end of his time as president, towards reducing Cold War tensions with Russia. And he was, of course, murdered. The Cold War rolls on for another 25 years. Was Russia as formidable militarily during that period as our media depicted? Or did we overstate how strong the Russians were?
No, the Russians were militarily very strong. They enjoyed a lot of popular support. One of the problems that we have is the Russians, again, unlike the Chinese, they're a Slavic people, so they neither fit in East nor West, but as a result, they can live alongside East or West. They're culturally speaking, their culture is different than the West, but they can be part of the West. They can live with Western democracies and whatnot. I mean, the Russians may always have some kind of czar themselves, but a peace between the Soviet Union and the United States was possible. The problem is the United States didn't want a bipolar world. The United States wanted a unipolar world. The United States wanted to be the exclusive superpower. They wanted a monopoly in the superpower game, basically.
It seems to be, you know, if you look at U.S. leadership today, you can draw a straight line from Cecil Rhodes and his round table. The idea that Rhodes had was is this world-encompassing British Empire, English-speaking empire dominated by Britain, which the United States was going to become a part of. And they always had this idea, and I think that it's one that's carried down to certainly to the United States today. When we entered World War I and II, it was for two reasons. It was first to eliminate the principal rival, which was the German Empire, and to pick up the pieces of our ally, or the British Empire, which we knew was on its way out.
And that's really what the Cold War was about, was defeating the Russian Empire,
the last
empire.
And of course, they make a huge strategic military mistake in 1979. When they invade Afghanistan, ironically, a place that we've been bogged down in now for many years. What does the Afghan war have to do with the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union?
You know, it's the same thing that when you look at what did Vietnam have to do with the economic problems of the mid to late 70s and 80s? It was a drain on the economy. It's just any kind of insurgency. Why is our economy today drained? Why are we up to our ears in debt? And the reason is because war in Afghanistan and fighting counterinsurgency is expensive. And that's really what it boiled down to for the Russians. And we drained them. You know, we funneled guns to the Mujahideen, who were the resistance fighters. Mujahideen being a very broad term. It means like soldiers of God, soldiers of the faith. We funneled money and intelligence and equipment and arms to them to drain the Russians.
This seems to be a game that both sides can play. The Russians did it to us in Vietnam, trapping basically 500,000 American troops there at one time in an unsuccessful effort to control Vietnam. And now we did it to the Russians in Afghanistan.
And ironically, now, once again, the Russians and the Chinese are doing it to us in places like Afghanistan. They did it to us in Iraq. The biggest supplier of arms to the Iraqi resistance were the Russians and the Chinese. The biggest supplier of arms to our enemies in Iran and North Korea are the Russians and the Chinese. So they're doing it to us again. That's nothing new, to be honest, nowadays. But that successfully drained the Russians, so that when Gorbachev withdrew from Afghanistan, really the Russian economy was in a very bad way. They were enormously in debt.
Yeah, Gorbachev comes to power in 1985. They are 6 years into this disastrous war in Afghanistan. And I guess he comes to the conclusion that they can't afford it anymore. And this all is happening at the time that President Ronald Reagan has embarked on this huge military spending program, Star Wars, which is, I don't know how much of it was actually realized in terms of practical weaponry, but it certainly scared the Russians, and they couldn't possibly keep up with the amount of money we were spending.
No, not at all. And that's ultimately, at the end of the day, we bankrupted the Russians. And that's ultimately what led to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Now, Gorbachev had, it seems to me, really fascinating ideas to change Russia. And history could have turned out a lot different when he takes power in 1985.
Well, the same way, yes, it could have with Khrushchev and the reaching out to Eisenhower.
Sure, Eisenhower and Kennedy. He came up with the idea of glasnost and perestroika. And the man is still alive, Gorbachev, but this is back in 1985. Glasnost, meaning opening, and perestroika, meaning restructuring. Can you talk about glasnost and perestroika?
Well, the idea was that what Gorbachev wanted to do was open up to the West. He wanted to begin to allow some forms of capitalism, although not absolute capitalism, but some forms of capitalism, foreign investment and whatnot, into the Soviet Union. He wanted, with the restructuring, to allow Soviet republics to gain nominal autonomy. The idea being that these republics could be communist if they choose, be pluralistic if they choose. And the idea was that he felt eventually they would see the error of the ways of capitalism and, again, return to the Soviet system. You know, it was one of those inevitable things. And ironically, we're starting to see in large parts of Eastern Europe is they're returning to Russia, the Ukraine, Belarus. They're all turning to a pro-Moscow system because the people, when they revolted, said, we want our independence. We want to kick the Soviets out. We want a Western-style system. They got the capitalism, but they didn't realize it's not a smooth transition because the West, particularly the United States, promised all of these little republics, you will all have the American dream. You know, flat-screen TVs, car in every garage.
He wanted to open the system. He also wanted to reinvent the Soviet Union as a voluntary association.
But that's what I'm saying.
Just to review some of the proposals of Gorbachev: freedom of speech. He freed thousands of political...
Freedom of religion.
He freed thousands of political dissidents from jail. He authorized multi-candidate elections. I guess before then you had to choose one guy, that was it. And he allowed non-communists to hold office. And he did something really interesting. He created a new Congress of people's deputies. And that was these people were elected, the deputies, in the first free election in Russia since 1917. So he really wanted to turn it to a Western style democracy. At the same time, as I understand it, he did not want to go to a total market economy. He drew the line there. He wanted to stay with a state planned economy, but he wanted to reduce the corruption, and he wanted to increase efficiency. Gorbachev specifically acknowledged that his economic program owed much to the Czech leader Alexander Dubček's, quote, socialism with the human face, yeah, which in the 60s, the idea being that you can have a socialist society, which is not an oppressive one.
Well, exactly. And that's also what I'm saying about he believed that, you know, systems would try different forms of government and ultimately different forms of different political parties and ultimately realized that socialism was the way.
Yeah, that was so exactly. It was a sense, it was a good system as far as he was concerned.
If I know I'm right, if I know what I'm saying is right, then if I know my ideas are right, then they will win on their own merit and I don't need to enforce them with an iron fist. The problem you had is that, again, that was not good enough for the United States.
Well, when you look at its foreign policy, though, Marchand, it seemed like things should have gone well with the United States. He fired his longtime foreign minister, Gromyko, who had been there for ages and ages. I think it was called Mr. Nyet because he was impossible to talk to, and replaced him with the much more sophisticated Edward Shevardnadze. And he had fairly good relations with Reagan and the other Western leaders. And he actually met Reagan in 1986 in Iceland, and they seemed to get along very well, and they came out with an agreement for an intermediate range nuclear missile treaty. And then, of course, he does eventually, in 88, order the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And most significantly, and I think this is a huge step that Gorbachev made, and it's too bad it didn't lead to world peace, he abandoned what was called the Brezhnev Doctrine, which under the Brezhnev Doctrine, the Russians believe that they had the right to control the internal affairs of the nations of Eastern Europe. And he said, nope, Gorbachev said, no, I'm not going to pursue that policy anymore. This was like a watershed event. And of course, within in a short time, the Eastern European nations ousted their communist regimes and embraced more Western-style
governments.
It's also
very important to note that during this time, Vladimir Putin, the current president of Russia, was KGB, I should say, later became the FSB, but a KGB lieutenant colonel in East Germany. And he'd been working there for quite a while, and he was there when the Berlin Wall fell. And Vladimir Putin was making calls to Moscow for troops, and he was denied. And I think one of the things that you see come out of this is somebody like Putin was very bitter about the loss of the empire.
So here we see an analogy between Lenin giving up the World War I, giving up the control of the Western territories, and Gorbachev freeing the Eastern European nations from Russian domination.
Exactly.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States.
Putin, much like Stalin, or even much like Peter the Great, who was bitter to see that Russia was a third world country lagging behind the West and being eaten at by, you know, the Germans, being eaten at by the Poles, being eaten at by the Ottomans, much in the same way. That's how Vladimir Putin saw it.
In March of 1990, under Gorbachev, the Soviet Constitution is amended in removing the Communist Party's monopoly over power. That was a huge concession, another watershed event equal to probably the Brezhnev Doctrine on the domestic side. And then also, Gorbachev is elected president of the Soviet Union by this newly democratic Congress of People's Deputies. Okay, so he now is developing a power base as an elected leader, independent of his position as a general secretary of the Communist Party, which essentially had been what the Russian leaders were. Now he's an elected leader, and he's getting non-communists added to his power base. Just a couple months later, Boris Yeltsin is elected chairman of the Russian Soviet Republic, and a year later, president of the Russian Federation. So we're having Gorbachev's concept is to change the Soviet Union from a Russian-dominated empire into more of a federation of equals,
exactly,
in which people participated in a voluntary, democratic federation. But then it all starts to fall apart at the end of 1990 and early 1991, when some of the republics, many of the republics are great on this idea. A lot of the republics think it's terrific, this new federation of the idea of Gorbachev, democratic, voluntary, let's go for it. But two of the federations, in particular, one of them is Russia, they decide that they don't want any part of it. And they assert the superiority of their own Russian laws over the new Soviet laws. And Yeltsin, in particular, goes into opposition to the new Soviet Union, and he wants to see it disintegrated. Okay. So that's really where we have to look at these events in 1990, 1991, Gorbachev's government being destabilized largely through Boris Yeltsin, as you say, the president of the Russian Federation. And we in the United States, it's known we were supporting secessionist movements in the Baltic republics. And I wouldn't be surprised if our agents were agitating for separatism elsewhere, because March, at the end of the day, we don't really want to see a stable, united Soviet Union, right?
No, because that means we have to share the world. And I think one of the things that that our listeners need to keep in mind, that the American people need to keep in mind, is that the power elites in this country, President Obama along with all of them, don't want a multipolar world. They don't want a strong China. They don't want a strong Russia. They want to dominate the world supply of oil, natural gas, precious metals, and they want to be able to dictate to the Russians and the Chinese, well, you might be big countries, but ultimately, at the end of the day, you're going to have to rely on us. So you have to comply with what we want. They don't want competition, and that's what the Russians and the Chinese are presenting, because the Russians and the Chinese want to play the same game. They want to push us out and dominate oil, natural gas, precious minerals, etc.
In August 1991, there's a coup d'etat which really puts the end to Gorbachev's very ambitious proposals. He's imprisoned briefly by communist hardliners, and then Boris Yeltsin, the president of the Russian Federation, emerges on the scene as the hero, and he ends up taking over.
Exactly. People thought that with Yeltsin, we'll have democratic reform, we'll have open elections and whatnot. And there was a protest, a demonstration in Moscow calling for elections, and the army was brought out to crush it with tanks. And so people very quickly, I mean, this was within the first year or so of Yeltsin.
They realized what he was. His priority was first. He actually Gorbachev resigned on Christmas Day in 1991. And the Soviet Union, as he envisioned the new Soviet Union, it was dissolved the next day.
Yes.
And Yeltsin actually moved into Gorbachev's office in the Kremlin. And he has two priorities. One is to go along with the dismantlement, the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And the other is to rapidly privatize the Soviet economy. Now the Russian economy.
And a lot of that was because he ran Russia like a mobster. I mean, he even referred to his inner circle as the family, very famously. He referred to his inner circle as the family. And there you can hear about this on a documentary called The Putin System, which is about the life of Vladimir Putin.
And really, you can't understand how Putin came to power unless you know how horrible the 1990s was for Russia under Yeltsin, with this auctioning off at ridiculously low prices of their state, publicly owned industry, to his cronies.
Exactly. And then at the same time, the invasion of Chechnya, the first invasion of Chechnya, which was disastrous and cost the Russians dearly.
Under Yeltsin.
That was the first Chechen war. And so for Russians, that was a period of, unless you were an oligarch, if you were an oligarch, you did great.
That's what they call this small group of well-connected businessmen who ended up with the ownership of the formerly public industries in Russia. And some of their financing came from Westerners, and of course, Western economists and Western governments were cheering on the privatization, just as we did, say, in Chile after the overthrow of Allende.
This
is going to be a great new world. However, for the Russian people, it was a disaster. There was wild inflation. Half of the Russians dropped to poverty. You had this emergence of this huge gap between the rich and the poor. You know, guaranteed jobs was a thing of the past. And then in 1998, the Russian ruble collapse. People lost all of their savings. The only reason why Yeltsin stayed in the power from 1991 to 1999 is that in 1996, when nobody liked him, some of his buddies got control of the media, and they funneled huge amounts of money into Yeltsin's political campaign for president.
So nobody ever heard of his opposition.
No.
You know? So that's the only way he won. But that's also why when Vladimir Putin comes on the scene in 1999, Putin knew who he hated, but Putin's a man with a mission. His mission is to restore the Soviet Union, the Soviet Empire, with him at its helm. He, at this time, ingratiated himself with Yeltsin. He, you know, did whatever Yeltsin needed. Yeltsin appointed him the head of the FSB, who he was had just been a lieutenant colonel in the KGB. The FSB was its successor. Now Putin's made the head of the FSB, and so he returns back to the FSB circle.
Putin is a career intelligence guy.
Yes, and a career communist. In 1991, he resigned from the KGB and joined in with some of the reformers, including Yeltsin, because he realized they were the future. But he never broke his ties with the FSB. or with the KGB, I should say. They were reformed, renamed the FSB, but it was still the same old crowd. What Yeltsin did unintentionally, because he thought, oh, Putin's one of my cronies, I can trust him. What he did unintentionally was he put Putin back into the KGB, basically, back into the FSB, and back at their helm. So now he became the FSB's man. This is kind of like being the CIA's man, you know? It makes you numero uno in the country, regardless of what anyone else says. It ensures your survival, because you are the representative for the FSB. And actually, quite recently, Putin, during a big banquet, famously said, I am proud to announce that once again, the FSB is in the Kremlin. You know, meaning that he, the KGB, was back in the Kremlin.
And so Yeltsin thought he was supporting him, and Yeltsin is pretty sick in 1999. He ends up resigning as president. Putin, who was prime minister, ends up becoming the president. And then he is elected a few months later. And I would think a democratic election gets, I think, 53% of the vote.
Yeah.
And then he's off and running. Basically, the Russia that we deal with today is the Russia of Putin.
He's exactly.
Either as president or prime minister or whatever other office they create for him since the end of 1999.
Real Putin. And that's why when he came to power with the help of the oligarchs, because the oligarchs said, oh, he's Yeltsin's chosen successor. The family accepts him. We can trust him. The first thing he did when he came to power was he started arresting the oligarchs, and he met with them and he said, look, you guys stay out of politics. That's it. You guys can keep doing what you do, but stay out of politics. And he knew they wouldn't. He knew they'd get pissed off. So they got all pissy and they said, oh, well, you can't do this to us. So he started running smear campaigns on Putin. So Putin, being Putin, has the FSB show up in the middle of the night to the headquarters of all of the news agencies. And when the reporters show up in the morning, they're all arrested and they all find out that they've been replaced. So there aren't any more independent TV or radio stations. They're all owned now by Gazprom, which is Putin's state-run, well, it was originally an oil company, but now it's an all-purpose company. It owns everything. It's really a state company. Mm-hmm. And it was founded by Putin. Putin basically is utterly ruthless.
But he's renationalizing these privatized
through industries. Gazprom, he's renationalized everything. And all of the oligarchs have either been arrested or forced to flee or died.
So here's a man who doesn't mess around.
No, he doesn't.
Well, can you contrast to the military under Yeltsin and the military under Putin?
Oh, absolutely. This is like looking at pre-Peter the Great Russian Army and then post-Peter the Great Russian Army. It was really a backwards Third World Army, kind of every other man being given a gun kind of a thing. You know, troops were starving, underpaid, under-equipped. Nepotism was rampant. Arms were being sold left and right. Military secrets and assets were being sold for the right price under Yeltsin. Putin comes in, and after the sinking of the Kursk, which was the pride of the Russian Navy, Putin lost it, and he fired all of his admirals.
This was a submarine?
This was a submarine that early in Putin's presidency sank to the bottom of the Barents Sea.
Due to incompetence?
Well, no one really knows. The fact is, though, is that it was used by the oligarchs to try to smear him, and that's really when he just went out and arrested all of them. He's like, that's it. I'm not even giving you guys a chance to behave yourselves. But then at the same time, he also sacked all of his generals. He sacked all of his admirals. And actually, quite recently, he had another wave of purges, if you will. He got rid of the Russian chief of staff of the Russian army, Makarov, replaced him with a combat veteran. He got rid of his secretary of defense, or his minister of defense, I should say, but replaced him with a guy named Shoigu, who is a Tartar, fiercely loyal and a combat veteran. Putin does is his purges weren't like Stalin's. They weren't blind. He's learned slowly who he can trust, who he can't trust, who's corrupt, who's not corrupt. And the moment he finds out they're corrupt, he replaces them with somebody who's not.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States. In addition to the changing the military leadership, he's made great strides that we've talked about on the war report in terms of military technology. Particularly, some of the weapons we've talked about are the new submarines. Can you talk about the advanced Russian submarines?
Oh, absolutely. The Bore-class submarine, which I think is an absolutely brilliant piece of hardware. It's a stealth submarine. It runs silent. I'm sure many of our listeners might have heard of the Hunt for Red October. This is basically a hunt for Red October in real life. This silent drive is it's underwater jet propulsion. It cycles the water through, it pushes it back out the back, but it makes no noise.
So it's not detectable.
It's utterly silent, not by sonar. And if you sail near the bottom of the ocean, you can't depict them, pick them up on radar either, because everything just starts bouncing off after a while. And this is where our intelligence community, you can tell it's all being allocated towards domestic spying, because we said, our intelligence guys said, the Russians say they got the stealth drive. They won't be able to put it to sea for another 20 years. The Russians have put 3 to sea already.
And they carry, as you've described before in the show, very advanced missiles.
The Bulava missile, which is one of the most sophisticated Russian missiles. It's one of the most sophisticated ballistic missiles in the world. It's considered a quasi-intercontinental ballistic missile because it is capable of being fired from a moving submarine, which makes it a pain in the butt to try to find and hit. You know, because traditionally submarines would have to stand still, fire the missile, which meant the moment that missile was launched, you knew where it was coming from. When you fire it on the move, the thing's friggin' gone by the time the missile makes an impact. The other thing is these Bulava missiles are equipped with countermeasures, computer-based evasive maneuvers. They're equipped to resist EMP blasts and nuclear blasts up to 500 meters away. They're capable of carrying inside 10 independently guided warheads, which means you could fire one over the East Coast and hit New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, Richmond, Norfolk, and still have 4 more warheads to spare.
And in the meantime, has the U.S. made strides that are comparable, or are we falling behind?
No, not at all. We've ignored it. For Americans, history ended in 1991. The Soviet Union fell, history ended. We would be dominant forever, kind of like Rome in its heyday. We would be dominant forever. Russia and China were backwards, and they would always be backwards. Nowadays, what you're starting to see is that Russia is becoming more militarily advanced. Well, just like when Germany became more militarily advanced, Russia should have upped the ante. Russia didn't. Now what we're seeing is Russia is becoming more militarily advanced, and we're not upping the ante. We're trying to ignore it. We're saying, no, Russia would never attack us. If the Russians and the Chinese do attack us, just like Hitler invading Russia, President Obama might go and hide for 2 weeks. I mean, that's literally because the reason why Stalin hid was because he was in denial that such a thing could happen. Well,
what are Putin's objectives?
Global domination.
But where are his priorities? Right now, we've got pretty much the Warsaw Pact nations roped into treaties with the United States and NATO. We're stationing missiles and radar in places like Romania and Poland.
He wants to push the United States out of Eastern Europe, Western Europe, out of the Middle East. China wants to push the United States out of Asia and Africa. So, and what you're seeing now is the United States, with the help of a few NATO partners, is going in wholeheartedly, full running speed into Africa, into the Middle East, trying to confront and kick out pro-Russian governments. And in the Far East, trying to prevent the Chinese from expanding. And in Africa, trying to kick out pro-Chinese governments all over the world.
It seems like that the Russians have been pretty quiet, relatively quiet, during the first decade or so of U.S. expansion after the pretext created by the World Trade Center bombing. The point where they seem to be drawing the line in the sand appears to be Syria.
I think so. They funded the Iraqi rebels. No big secret. And I think after we withdrew from Iraq, Russia thought, when we invaded Iraq, Russia thought, we'll just drain them in Iraq like we did in Vietnam. That'll be that. Well, when we started expanding militarily further into the Middle East, trying to topple Assad in Syria, trying to attack Iran.
And of course, Libya did fall.
Yes, but Iran especially, which shares a mutual defense treaty with Russia, Russia realized that we weren't playing around.
The Russians have said that any Western move against Iran, they would regard as a serious threat to their own national security.
Is in matter of fact the equivalent of a treaty as far as the Russians are concerned.
And of course,
same reason why they invaded Austro-Hungary.
And of course, Iran is the great prize, as General Wesley Clark pointed out in his interview, which he described the seven nations that were listed in a 2001 Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense memo about seven nations we were going to take over in the next several years. And the great prize of the seven was Iran, because it is the largest combined reserves of oil and natural gas in the world. Russia is the only other.
It's gone, though, even far and beyond that. And I think that's what the Russians see. Before, it was just about us taking over seven countries. But now it's really the global gambit. Well, and that's what the Russians see. Because if I may, the Russians see us. Mali was not on the original list. Neither was Algeria.
Right.
But the fact is
the war keeps expanding. Now it's North Africa.
That's just it. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yes.
Is that the war is expanding and spiraling. So that's why the Russians realized they had to up the ante. And they also realized that if they don't stop us militarily, we will continue to expand. Because what they hoped to do is drain us in Iraq the way they did in Vietnam. We would wring our hands and walk away, but we didn't. We've continued to expand above and beyond what they originally thought we were going to do.
I would think any objective person coming from elsewhere, another planet, would look at the world situation and say that Russia today is reacting to Western aggression, whether it's in Syria, North Africa, against Iraq, Iran, is that a fair way to describe it?
It's one empire acting towards the aggression of another. Russia isn't this altruistic power just defending itself. It's defending its empire. Equally, we're defending our empire. We're expanding our empire. They're expanding theirs. We are the aggressors in this situation. We could have tried to make peace with the Russians back in the 90s. We could have tried to do it in the 60s.
Gorbachev, too, would have been such an ideal opportunity to create world peace.
Khrushchev, Gorbachev, we could have done it. But we screwed it up. We screwed it up completely. We screwed it up again in the 2000s when Iran under Khatami came to the U.S. and said, look, we'll never have Victoria's Secret models on our billboards. Just forget about it. But we do want to open up to the West. And President Bush said, go to hell. You guys are part of the axis of evil. And that led to the rise of Ahmadinejad and the alliance with Russia.
Right. So all these opportunities, we didn't want to pursue them.
No. And so in reality, the biggest problem now is that we've squandered our opportunities for peace. So the only shot we have left at peace is to withdraw and give up the control of the world, with the exception of the continental U.S., to the Russians and the Chinese.
It seems like we put ourselves in a corner because at this point we have so upped the ante, in particular in the Mideast. They don't want us to control Iran, so they're going to have to react and say, well, we're going to make that region within our sphere of influence, not only for the oil resources, but for the pipelines that are going to go from there up to Europe. And this plays into NATO. And I think you said earlier they would like to break up NATO. If Western Europe is wholly dependent on the Russians for natural gas, then why would they stay allied with the United States?
Well, exactly. And that's what the Russians know. Putin said in his own manifesto that he who controls the world's supply of natural resources controls the world. So I think one thing to bear in mind as we're seeing the situation unravel is we're not giving an inch to the Russians or to the Chinese. The Chinese say those Doyu Islands belong to us. Well, instead of the United States stepping in like we should and saying, look, let's mediate this dispute, we're just saying, the Chinese will never do anything. The North Koreans say they have the bomb and they're going to launch it at the U.S. Who cares? Well, the problem is that all it would take at this point is a spark. All it would take is for Iran at the behest of Russia to attack the U.S. fleet. All it would take is North Korea at the behest of China hit the U.S. Because make no mistake, at this point, the empires are getting within a hair's inch of fighting each other.
Well, you describe Putin as a Bolshevik Peter the Great.
Exactly. And the premier of China sees himself as the new Qin Shuang Di, the first emperor of China. The head of the Chinese military, People's Liberation Army Military Academy said, the commandant of the academy said, our entire training regime is designed to fight the United States. And the North Koreans have said, we are preparing missiles and nukes to launch at the U.S. They say the only language the U.S. understands is force. The Russians, meanwhile, have shipped in missiles into Syria and thousands of troops. They have 15 large ships. They have the largest fleet ever assembled by the Russian Navy in the 20th century, or 21st century, I should say, in the Mediterranean. The world powers are ready to go to war. The question is what's going to spark it? And something I want people to bear in mind is when World War I broke out, nobody knew where Serbia was. People couldn't believe World War I was breaking out because of an Austro-Hungarian invasion of Serbia. So
Putin is in the mold of Peter the Great. He's not a guy like Gorbachev who's looking for a rapprochement at this point. No.
At this point, both he and the Chinese have been demonstrated to that force is the only thing that will push the U.S. out. And there are plans on the table in the Kremlin and in Beijing. Remember, it's a joint effort to invade and bomb the continental United States. So these are white papers that are put out by the People's Liberation
Army. Could
you say
that one more time?
There are plans on the books in the Kremlin, new plans in the Kremlin and in Beijing to bomb and invade the U.S. And
where can people read about this sort of stuff?
If you Google online Russian military white paper Chinese People's Liberation Army white paper. If you Google People's Liberation, PLA General, War with the U.S. Sometimes it's hard to find a Google because Google censors. Google censors in China and North Korea. It would censor in the U.S. too. But so sometimes it can be a little difficult to find. But you
can. But basically, they're anticipating the. And we in the United States, as we talked about much earlier, in relationship to the Russian experience with the Mongol invasions, we don't have experience with invasions. It was just the War of 1812. No. And we can't seem to wrap our heads around the idea that this could happen. So we send our troops willy-nilly to Africa, and we're dispatching more and more troops to Africa. People don't know that we have a U.S. Africa command. What in the world we need a U.S. Africa command is something I think the people should talk about. We're sending troops all over the world without thought to the fact that we may be provoking our global rivals to attack us.
Well, and what people don't understand, and again, I hear this all the time, Russia would never invade, China would never invade, they can't do that. Behind every blade of grass, there will be a gun. But the problem is that the Russians and the Chinese combined can field one soldier for every living American, which are odds that we didn't have in World War II. When we invaded Germany, we didn't have one U.S. soldier for every German citizen. The Chinese and the Russians combined could field one soldier for every U.S. citizen. Moreover, technologically, they're far superior. And even moreover, the Chinese way of war is total, especially, and the Russians as well, is total and absolute. It would not be beyond them to kill half of our population. When the Russians invaded Berlin, they murdered and raped as part of their protocol to terrorize the population so they wouldn't fight an insurgency.
So what would your advice be to the American military or civilian leadership?
It would be pull in. Pull in. It's time we defend the homeland. We have to relocate our military bases to positions that are defensible, to strategic points. We need to harden our infrastructure against EMP attacks. We need to rebuild air raid shelters. We need to have a way of notifying people en masse of an attack. Because nowadays they have, everybody can get a text from FEMA if they sign up for it in the event of an attack. Well, not really. You know, I mean, if we're being invaded, we have to have air raid sirens. We have to have a better response. We have to get rid of FEMA and put the military back in charge of disaster response. Because at the end of the day, why does nobody invade Switzerland? Because it's heavily armed and its entire country is designed for defense. Every bridge in Switzerland is built with explosives attached to it so that the bridges can be blown up on a moment's notice. That's what we need to have, is we need to make America a fortress and no one will ever attack us. Not terrorists. If we build our defenses, put surface-to-air missile stations along our coast and on the interior, if we, you know, stop illegal immigration to prevent enemy agents and terrorists from coming in south or even to the north, no one will ever attack us. But so long as our entire military is overseas, a child with a pea shooter could attack us. We don't have an early warning system. The amount of warning we would get if Russian submarines or Chinese submarines were to launch an attack on the continental U.S. would be, if we were lucky, 30 seconds before impact. And we have no way of warning people en masse that an attack's coming. We have no air raid shelters. And if we had to mobilize our troops, look at what happened with Hurricane Sandy. People were out of their homes and out of power for weeks. What would happen if you were to have a mass attack on the U.S.?
Well, thank you very much, Marshawn. It's some very provocative analysis.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe in the concluding episode of a two-part series on Russia's history and its reemergence as a rival to the U.S. for global power today. In future war reports, we will continue to report on the Russian challenge and analyze its implications for U.S. foreign and military policy. In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. Check out In Context on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.